Welcome back to Canna Week, brought to you by New Frontier Data, where we deliver the week's top headlines in cannabis and hear experts weigh in on the impacts these stories are having on the industry. I'm your host, Heather Wickline. Today, we're going to dive into all things 280E, federal tax policy, and a look to what the future of the cannabis industry holds. Today, we're excited to welcome back a longtime partner and friend to New Frontier Data. He is a partner and the co-practice director for the DC Metro Tax Practice for Cohn Resnick. And for the past 3 years, he has been focused his efforts on growing the tax services of the Cohn Resnick cannabis practice. Please welcome Michael Harlow. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having me again. You know, I think that just shows how dated this is and how the last year has just gotten away for us, because I think it's actually been 4 years now, but I probably wrote that a year ago. So yep. We've all been working together so long, it just seems like yesterday.
I love it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, thanks for being here. And our next guest is our in-house expert. He is the Chief Knowledge Officer at New Frontier Data. Please welcome the brilliant Mr. John Cagia.
Delighted to be back, Heather. Thank you for having me.
All right. Well, we're going to dive right in. MJBizDaily.com reported newly released IRS documents detail efforts to collect taxes from marijuana companies under 280E. So, Michael, I know this is something that you've gone over a million times, but for our listeners, can you give us a brief rundown on 280E and how does it impact the legal cannabis industry?
Happy to. Yes. We talked about this once or twice a day for the past 5 years. So I have to do it one more time. So for those of you that might be new to the industry, IRC 280E is Internal Revenue Code section that specifically deals with trafficking in illegal narcotics. And, you know, at the end of the day, basically what it says is you can't take any deductions, credits, or any other benefits in calculating taxable income other than cost of goods sold for any business that traffics in a Schedule 1 or 2 narcotic. So what that means for the cannabis industry, it's a hugely punitive tax because cannabis operators can't deduct anything than the cost of the actual acquiring or improving the product. There continue to be court cases about 280E. The San Jose Wellness case was settled just a couple weeks ago. None of them, for the most part, have been favorable to the industry. The IRS and the courts continue to take a very broad view of 280E. And it's important for operators to understand as you're getting in the industry, it's something you have to focus on. It's something you have to cash manage for. You are going to have a big tax bill at the end of the year. There's several ways that we can help minimize it with structuring ahead of time, but there is no fix for 280E. I think many in the industry continue to hope for this kind of this Hail Mary that there's going to be some court case that finds 280E unconstitutional or somehow fixes the problem. And I just don't think that's going to happen. So until we see some reform at the federal level, it's going to continue to be a major, major problem for the industry. Generally speaking, we see cannabis dispensaries paying effective tax rates closer to 60-70%. And the standard corporate tax rate in the U.S. is 21%, just to give you some idea of the scope of the problem for operators. And even though we've talked about this time and time again, it continues to be a pain point for clients and cannabis operators. I was talking with a client just a couple of weeks ago as we were finalizing their tax returns, and his comment to me was that it was really unfair. He didn't think the federal government understood and that they were making it almost impossible for him to grow his business. And I had to point out to him that he was absolutely correct. It is unfair. It is punitive. And no, they're not helping you grow your business. As far as the IRS or the feds are concerned, you're still a criminal. 280 still applies. And that's just the harsh reality of it.
Well, that puts them at a massive disadvantage. So what are some recommendations that you tell your clients to do to like protect themselves?
Sure. So, as we saw in the articles, the MJBiz articles and the documentation, the training manuals they got out of the IRS using the FOIA request, the IRS is definitely eager to go after cannabis operators because they know it's easy. They know that generally speaking, most cannabis operators are small startup businesses. Their record keeping is probably not pristine. Their accounting system is probably not, top of the line. the books and records are probably messy, then they know that they can go in and easily recalculate cost of goods sold, assess a significant tax liability without expending a lot of hours. So some of the things that we advise clients to do are really pretty basic. Like, make sure that your books and records are in tip-top shape. Make sure your accounting records are all reconciled. Make sure your bank account's reconciled. Make sure that...
So step one, hire Cohn Resnick. To help
them. But if you look at the court cases that have been taken and lost, or taken to court and lost, they're not really great cases to have been brought to begin with. Oftentimes, you know, the taxpayers commingled cannabis and non-cannabis activities. The books and records are non-existent. Like, there just isn't a lot of leg for the taxpayer to stand on. There's not a lot of documentation they can provide to support their cost of goods sold calculation. And I think the IRS knows this. And I think as the IRS is looking at different cannabis operators, I assume that they're doing some cost benefit analysis to decide who to spend time focusing on. And you know, I can't prove this, that the IRS isn't going to release this information, but I would have to assume that if you run a very professional organization, you have good books and records, you have audited financial statements, you have support for your cost of goods calculation, you have a good inventory record, there's going to be much less holes the IRS can poke in your operations. And they're probably going to move forward faster because they know the next operator they look at is not going to be in that shape. So I don't think they're going to spend nearly as much time on that, that organized, well-documented, sophisticated operator as they will on, you know, the next one that they talk to whose books and records amount to a shoebox.
Right. John, you're pretty well versed in 288 as well. What's your take on this?
To Michael's point, it's really striking how much of a pain point this continues to be, even relative to how quickly the industry is growing. So striking that if by our estimates in 2020, the industry generated $20 billion worth of revenue within the markets where it's currently legal, reflective of a really fast growing market, because the bulk of that was in the adult use markets. Adult use is only legal about 6 years. But it is curious that even as this industry is growing at this kind of meteoric pace, for entrepreneurs who are bearing the burden of a 60, 70, 75, 80% tax rate, that people are still rushing into this space. And I think there's this kind of twin expectation. One, that this is going to be a phenomenally large market. And two, that a lot of these pain points on the regulatory side are going to be addressed as industry approaches its next chapter. But given the number of states that have legalized now and that are going to be activating markets over the next 2 to 4 years, I think this really now starts putting a great deal of pressure on lawmakers, on congressional lawmakers, and on the administration to finally address this issue. The market is getting to a point where some of these drogues to growth, these impediments to growth, are not going to be sustainable. They're not indefinitely sustainable. And ultimately, even lawmakers who have been historically opposed to increasing access or streamlining and smoothing the industry's operations are coming around because they're now representing jurisdictions where it's where cannabis is legal and their own constituents have a stake in this. It will ultimately have to get addressed, but it continues to be a major hamstringing factor in the market. And one of the questions I had for Michael, actually, given that we're now kind of 6 years post adult use legalization, have you seen the margins improve, say within retailers? You know, if your retailers are paying 60, 70, 75% tax rates relative to sub 30 in the rest of the economy, are cannabis businesses just really profitable with allowing them to take this tax hit and continue operating? Or are they taking this as a loss with expectation that once this is resolved and the law is reformed, then the business will take off?
Well, so good questions. I think there's a couple misunderstandings, both by the general public and by the policymakers. I think there's this assumption that cannabis operators are just rolling in cash, mm-hmm. and that, you know, the 280E hit is like not that big a deal for them because they're just printing money. That's not our experience. You know, what we see, particularly with privately owned dispensary groups, is that it's absolutely killing them. Like, they are not cash flowing after they pay their tax. They're generally not generating sufficient cash flow to make distributions to owners or investors. Mm-hmm. And that is what I tell people when they start getting into the business, they're looking at the business. If you're investing because you think you're going to generate positive cash flow return to distribute to yourself or to your investors, you're not. Mm-hmm. Your focus should be staying in business, you know, paying your taxes, and growing your market share as much as possible so that when there is reform or legalization, you're in a positive position to capitalize on that. But you're really, it's going to be extremely difficult to cash flow positive after tax for a dispensary operation. Cultivation is a little bit different in that a larger percentage of our legitimate cost of goods sold. And we see cultivators, particularly in some new markets like Michigan, who are doing extremely well and are generating positive cash flow for distributions. But at the retail side, no, right now, your business strategy should be just to stay in business, grow your market share, and prepare for either legalization or some kind of consolidation if, you know, you're planning on exiting within the next 4 to 5 years. But don't quit your day job. You know, we talk to a lot of people who are going to retire from their existing career, which pays their salary to pay their bills and their living expenses, and they're going to, you know, open their first retail dispensary. I wouldn't recommend that.
Yeah, sorry, it's not exactly the green rush that everybody thinks it is.
No, I mean, they're doing very well. But when you're paying 60-70% effective tax rate, that's still not feasible.
Really, really good perspective there. And thank you for sharing that, Michael, because I agree. I think that's something that people don't understand. They hear about the big top line numbers and assume that that's going to industry, but death and taxes. And on this one, Uncle Sam is winning.
And from I forgot the second part of my point is that from the policymaker's perspective, you know, I've heard from several sources that, legislatures are hesitant to move forward without a matching revenue component to any bill because they think that legalizing and eliminating 280E is going to be a net revenue loss for the federal government. And therefore, the theory is it has to be replaced with some new revenue generation tool, excise tax or the national sales tax or something else. I think that dramatically overstates or understates the number of operators that are actually following 280E correctly. I think there's probably a huge underreporting within the industry. And also keep in mind that 280E was not created 6 years ago. 280E was created back in the early 1980s, specifically for illegal operations. So if there's this assumption that I think is completely crazy that illicit operators are filing tax returns and correctly applying 280E. I find that hard to believe. My view, and it's very hard to prove, is that if you were to move forward with a legalization at the federal level, you transition illicit operators into the legal regulated market, they actually file income tax returns. My guess is that revenue generation would more than make up for current revenue generated by 280E. But that's a very difficult calculation to prove.
Right. Well, we want to switch gears a little bit because I want to look ahead to the future and how some of these issues might be resolved. Wine and Spirits Wholesalers of America released a report outlining a potential avenue for federal oversight of the adult use cannabis supply chain based on the federal alcohol regulatory model. So first, Michael, can cannabis be regulated like alcohol? And how do the markets compare?
I think it would be very difficult. If you look at the white paper you mentioned, as well as some of the legislation that passed the House last year, originally the legislation that passed the House had a 5%, essentially a national excise tax, calculated based on retail sales. There are some constitutional reasons why that might be problematic about whether or not the federal government can assess a sales tax in individual state markets. But from an accounting and tax perspective, that would have been relatively easy to administer. You have metric, you have the point of sale system, you have the cash deposits, the credit card receipts, you have like a dozen different audit trails that could prove out that sales number and could support the excise tax calculation. So to me, the administrative burden was relatively low. Of course, nobody wants to advocate for an additional excise tax in cannabis, but from a purely administrative standpoint, it seemed reasonable. The final version that passed, there were some articles that referenced the rate went from 5% up to 8%. So 1 year escalator, so 5, 6, 7, 8. What received much less press was that the calculation of the excise tax changed too. It became an excise tax based on wholesale transfer prices. And the verbiage was basically copied word for word out of the alcohol excise tax regulations. It even included some terms like when removed from bond being an alcohol term, dating back to the post-prohibition era. This is really problematic for the industry because that's not the way the industry is currently structured. Most large operators we see are moving towards a vertically integrated structure. Well, if the excise tax is being assessed when something is removed from the warehouse, the wholesale warehouse, and transferred to the retail environment, that would imply that distribution and retail are two separate entities, and that there's a fair market value price, at arm's length transaction between the two. Well, if you're dealing in a world where everybody's trying to achieve full vertical integration, you don't have that separation. So now you're assessing this excise tax on what's effectively an inter-party or related party transaction between the same company. It seems to me that that's going to be very difficult to administer. So if you look at alcohol now as compared to cannabis, you can't have manufacturing, distribution, and retail in an alcohol environment. But that's what cannabis is moving towards. And one of the reasons why you can't have that in alcohol is because you have to have some entity, in this case, the distribution companies, that administer the excise tax and remit that. So I'm very concerned that if the white paper you referenced or the current tax legislation moves forward, it would be a huge disruptor to the industry. I mean, you could theoretically see vertically integrated MSOs then having to divest of retail and or distribution when legalization does occur. So I think there's some basic structural reasons why it doesn't work. And then you go into all kinds of other issues that are not really within my purview, but is it fair to compare the concept of alcohol proof to THC, milligrams or percentages in cannabis? Is that, the white paper you referenced suggested that having a higher excise tax on spirits as opposed to beer and wine had some social benefit because there was a higher tax on more intoxicating beverages. I don't know that that's, one, I'm not sure I completely believe that. And two, I don't know that translates. How do you measure that? That measuring proof in alcohol, from my understanding, is relatively straightforward. Don't think you're going to be able to make the same comparison when comparing, flower, processed product, edibles, vapes. So I foresee there being a lot of complications in the administration of those taxes if you try to just overlay a proof-based concept onto cannabis.
I think I'm a little concerned with someone just copying and pasting something into a new policy. John, what's your take on this?
I'm very sympathetic to the policymakers' orientation to try and find an analog that allows you to more efficiently and expeditiously build regulations to govern cannabis. The problem is, you know, cannabis is dissimilar enough from a lot of the analogs that people are looking at that it works part of the way, but then gets really, really messy really, really quickly. And I think Michael has given some great examples of that. Dismantling vertical integration in this industry, I think, would be hugely, hugely disruptive. And not just for the large operators. There's a lot of smaller and mid-sized companies that are doing really well for their size and have strong growth prospects. But the question I would kind of put to the lawmakers that were entertaining this idea of vertical integration prohibited market is, what is the value to the market of taking that approach? It might have made sense when it was done for alcohol prohibition to try and mitigate the size of the companies, but really what is expected to be the market benefit, either on the regulatory side or on the consumer side? What is the benefit of going with a kind of fragmented supply chain? Second, to this question Michael asked, and I think it's a really interesting one because we're seeing more debate around it right now than I think we have ever, is this idea of THC caps and how potent is too potent in cannabis. Because it dovetails with this issue of proofing alcohol versus kind of what is equivalent potency in cannabis. There seems to be some debate around one, THC caps for flower. I know there's a debate happening in Florida right now as you speak. And then two, a debate that's happening in multiple markets around potency caps in the value-added categories of the market. So for example, creating standards where there's a maximum potency you can have in a vape pen, there's a maximum potency you can have in a concentrate, there's a maximum potency you can have in edibles. But we still so know little about the physiology of cannabis and how it interacts with individuals that even trying to decide what a single serving, what a single dose is for a consumer, I don't think has been codified yet. So while we have these analogs on the alcohol side of a shot to a glass of wine to a bottle of beer, I don't think we have yet industry-wide come up with a similar color rally. I just mutilated that, but you know what I'm trying to say.
Corollary?
Yes, what Michael said. But so what is that?
We've done this before.
but what is that unit of measure that becomes the one single serving that can be used industry-wide? And these are some of the really foundational things that I think we need to understand before we establish a superstructure of regulations that then become misaligned with the actual evolution of the market. So this is going to get messy, and we share some of Michael's concerns around what trying to copy and paste the alcohol model into cannabis is. So what we have been advising is caution, allowing time for the market to continue to evolve and really understanding how at the state level, the regulatory levers that have been pulled have impacted the market's performance, really taking those into careful consideration before we formalize a national policy. Because as we have seen, for example, in the EU with the novel foods regulations impact on CBD and how much the market has slowed in its growth because of this novel food regulation, we would be similarly concerned that a regulation, a really stringent regulation on the federal side in the US could have a really consequential, constrictive effect on the future growth of the market.
Yeah, so I don't think there's a perfect corollary. And to your point, I completely understand why, from a policymaker standpoint, and also from, you know, the industry standpoint, adopting alcohol or any other existing regulation could be a benefit because policymakers understand it. And it's easier, it may be easier to advance federal legislation if we're speaking in terms that the policymakers already understand. So I understand why that's an attractive way to advance, legislation, but, the devil's in the details. And on one hand, you have state governments who are moving in the direction of awarding more micro licenses for full vertical integration, partially as a way to, as components of social equity programs. And then on the flip side, this federal, if we follow alcohol, that could break up those micro licenses and create, essentially a monopoly on distribution companies in certain markets, which is going to run counter to advancing more opportunities for social equity applicants. So like we've had for the history of medical and recreational legalization, we have a federal and state policies that are, at a head that are going to be difficult to resolve.
One additional point there, and you alluded to this earlier, Michael, and this was about 280E, but I think it has a parallel here, which is even though cannabis remains illegal under federal law, that does not mean that the federal government is not looking for ways to kind of maximize its capitalization on this industry. It's doing it with 280E on the tax side, which is why they're looking for kind of that replacement revenue option. But I think there's also a similar lens that's influencing their approach to cannabis, which is, if there's some begrudging of the legalization of cannabis, then I think that's going to influence the way some of these regulations are being designed, and not necessarily with the interests of the industry kind of front and center, or at least central to how some of these governance issues are addressed.
Well, thank you. Well, I just wanted to say before we wrap up, I wanted to get your predictions when it comes to federal policy and cannabis in 2021 and the years to come. Michael, I'll throw it to you first.
I'm a little less optimistic than I was a couple months ago. Earlier in the year, I was telling clients that my prediction was that we'd see some movement next year. If historical trends hold and the Democrats lose the House next year, that means they have to get this passed before next year's midterms. But we haven't seen a heck of a lot of activity to date. It seems like in the Senate, everybody has kind of stood down while they wait to see what Schumer puts forward. I don't think anybody wants to get ahead of the of Schumer's office. Even safe banking, which I think got 15 more Republican votes now than it did when it was first introduced last year, 2 years ago. So that's positive. But I don't think we're going to see anything until late next year. The Biden administration is clearly more receptive, but I don't think they're cannabis fans. And I think the administration has a lot of other things that they want to focus on right now. I think they're focused on scoring some victories with infrastructure, with some tax reform. And I think cannabis is going to come after that. So I guess my prediction is, cross your fingers for late in 2022.
Nice. John, what's your prediction?
I share that. History has been so reliable in this idea that, when one party controls the House, the Senate, and the White House, generally they will lose their first midterm election in the House. So there's going to be phenomenal pressure on the Democrats to get something done before the midterms, particularly given how contentious we expect the next electoral cycle to be. However, if nothing gets done before the midterms, I think then it becomes a bit of a wild card on what happens next. Does the Democrat win in 2024, thereby kind of reviving the likelihood of major federal reform? Or does the hope then become that national attitudes, both within the public and the political class, are moving towards support for legalization fast enough that regardless of whether a Democrat or Republican wins the next presidential cycle, that there'd be enough kind of political support to have that conversation. It is to me still unclear which of those two are, or which of those two trajectories we could be on. But you know, we think it would be a missed opportunity for the Democrats if they didn't try to get something done before the 2022 cycle and not have to risk either trying to do this between the 2022 and 2024 when they're still in power but dealing with a divided Congress, or potentially losing the White House in 2024 and then having to build an entirely new coalition around this issue.
Yeah, the other thing that I would remind people of is those of us that follow the industry closely understand how complicated this is. But the general public, John probably could cite the statistics, is generally becoming more and more supportive of legalization, both medical and recreational. So if you pose a question to the general public and they'd say, yes, vote for legalization. And then again, you get into the details. Well, how does that affect criminal justice reform? How does that affect social equity programs? How do you modify tax policy to account for that? How do you regulate food and beverages? Like, it would touch, it touches so many different parts of the federal government. It's going to be a really big, complicated bill. And that's just, you know, the truth of the matter.
And that's, Michael, why you know, we've been talking about this idea of easy to legalize, difficult to regulate. I think this is going to be a case study in that. General consensus that something should be done, but the devil is absolutely going to be in the details.
Yeah, I have, my sister-in-law lives in New Jersey, and she was like, they legalized, when is it going to start? And I was like, oh, sister, there's we got a long road before that happens.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much, both, and thank you to our listeners for joining us on Canada Week. Please be sure to like and subscribe to the podcast and hit the notification bell so you don't miss any upcoming episodes. And if you haven't already, please sign up for our free weekly newsletter at newfrontierdata.com/newsletter-signup. I'm your host, Heather Wickline, and we will see you next time. New Frontier Data provides this podcast for entertainment purposes only. Nothing stated in this podcast should be taken as legal or financial advice. Reference to any specific product or entity does not constitute an endorsement or recommendation by the company. The views expressed by guests are their own, and their appearance on the program does not imply an endorsement of them or any entity they represent. Views and opinions expressed by New Frontier Data employees are those of the employees and do not necessarily reflect the view of the company or any of its officials. If you have any questions about this disclaimer, please contact our legal department.